Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/acast. That's 15% off at burrow.com/acast.
Welcome to Season 5, Episode 4 of They Walk Among Us, a podcast dedicated to UK true crime. This episode contains distressing themes and descriptions of sexual violence. This podcast is intended for a mature audience. Listener caution is advised. It is a scene reserved only for your worst nightmares. You live alone, but there is suddenly a stranger in your bedroom. He does not have to unfasten the zipper over his mouth on the black leather mask he is wearing to say why he is there. Prominent against the dim light and the dark leather, there is one word scrawled crudely in white capital letters across the forehead of the mask. Rapist. Cambridge is a distinguished, picture-perfect university city in the east of England. The summer brings people out in droves, hiring punt boats to have fun on the river while being surrounded by the scenic views and historic buildings of the city. Due to the extensive and much sought-after educational opportunities, it attracts young students from around the world. It's a popular tourist destination, with bicycles as the preferred method of transport. Bikes can be seen everywhere in the centre of the city, lines of them bolted to metal railings while their owners go to class or take in the sights. Student accommodation is also in high demand. Many of the old houses have been converted by landlords into flats or bedsits, a bedroom with a sink, sharing bathroom facilities with the rest of the house. Cambridge is a place where many students live alone for the first time, settling into a new city, perhaps thousands of miles from home. For 8 months between 1974 and 1975, excitement and anticipation were replaced by caution and fear for the women living in Cambridge. On October 18, 1974, the first reported attack occurred on Springfield Road in the middle of what was described as Bedsit Land in the centre of Cambridge. A student in her early 20s was sitting on her bed in a bath towel, watching the Morecambe and Wise television show. The two other residents who she shared the property with were out for the evening, leaving her alone on the top floor of the building, or so she thought. Without warning, the light bulb began to flicker. Then the lights went out. The TV too. Assuming the power was cut, in the darkness she started looking for a candle so she could investigate what the problem was. She went to the doorway and called out. There was no reply. She locked the door. Preoccupied while also trying to find some matches in the dark, she slowly heard the sound of the door being unlocked. Abruptly, before she knew what was going on, there was a man in her room. A scarf covered the lower part of his face, and he was dressed in casual clothing. He had a weapon, and chillingly warned her, "I've got a very sharp knife and one silly move, and there will be a lot of blood. I came to rob you, but I think I'll rape you first." The man tied up his terrified victim and put a pillowcase over her head. After the traumatic attack, the intruder stole £12 in cash, tucking the bound woman in bed before he fled the scene, and the alarm was raised. The Cambridgeshire Constabulary found the attack extremely concerning and set up a team of detectives to track down the man responsible. As far as they knew, the inquiry team were investigating a single rape case, but this was the first attack of many during an 8-month reign of terror. At the start of November, 2 weeks after the first, there was a second attack. The rapist struck again. This time he went to a bedsit on Abbey Road, less than a mile southeast, back in the heart of where most students lodge near their universities. Similar to the first attack, the victim was a 20-year-old student. Relaxing in the bath, she watched as the light suddenly went out. Getting out of the water and putting on her bathrobe, the woman walked into the hallway to call out to one of her flatmates to check what the problem was. She shared the house with three other people, two females and a male. She could make out the silhouette of a man standing at the bottom of the stairs as her eyes were adjusting to the darkness. She called out one of her flatmates' names, "Dick?" As he was walking up the stairs, a voice said, "Yes." Before she could react to the realization it was not her flatmate, the man had run up the stairs and forced a pad soaked with ether over her mouth. She was told, "Shut up, or I will kill you." She was dragged to her bedroom, tied up, and a handkerchief was forced into her mouth. The man said, "That's good. That's good," as the woman screamed. After the horrendous ordeal was over, the attacker fled out the back door into the darkness before the lights went on, and the woman managed to wriggle free, running to a neighbor's house to contact the police. It was clear there was a commonality shared between the two crimes, and the same man was responsible. The survivors of the attacks described their assailant as short, perhaps 5'4" tall, and probably a similar age to his victims, likely in his early 20s. Through an appeal in newspapers, the Cambridgeshire Constabulary cautioned women in the area to keep their doors and windows locked at all times. During the evening of November 11th, on Huntingdon Road, again in Bedsitland, an Australian student in her early 20s was ironing her clothes. Home alone, she heard a noise from the back garden. It sounded as though someone had climbed over the fence. She peered outside, but no one was there. Perhaps it was a cat roaming the garden, or maybe the noise came from the neighbours. She got back to ironing some clothes until about 20 minutes later. The sound of the doorbell echoed through the house. She wasn't expecting company, but went to the door. Stood before her was a man short in stature, someone she didn't recognise, although he was wearing a disguise. The woman would describe what she saw to the police. He was wearing a light brown shoulder-length wig and a grey knitted scarf wrapped around the bottom half of his face. He wore a black leather jacket and black leather gloves. Apart from that, he was naked. As the man lunged forward, his intended victim panicked. The unexpected guest was kicked hard in the groin. During the struggle, his wig was pulled off and thrown in his face as he stumbled outside. The door was slammed on the doubled-up man before he scuttled away, fleeing the woman and her lodgings. The sound heard in the garden was likely the rapist peering in through a window to make sure the woman was home alone. The police were called and a search of the area was undertaken. However, the man was not tracked down. He later managed to return to the scene undetected to retrieve the wig. Unfortunately, the culprit was not deterred, and just a few days later he lay in wait, heavily disguised at Homerton College, where he targeted an 18-year-old student. She was practicing in a soundproof music room in a separate building to the Central College. It was dark outside, and the other rooms were empty. She was engrossed in playing the cello until everything went black. All the lights had gone out, leaving the teenager to feel her way to the corridor. As she stepped forward, a man leapt out, forcing a pad over her mouth that had been dipped in ether or chloroform. She screamed, but in a soundproof building, no one could hear her from the outside. "I'm going to murder you," he said. He threw a curtain over her head, and before the student knew it, he had dragged her across the grounds to a shed. The attacker must have planned the assault because he knew where all the buildings were located and where he could and could not go so as to not be disturbed. His verbal aggression paled in comparison to what happened next. During the brutal rape, he bit his victim's breast. Following the attack, he told her to wait on the ground while he went to the practice rooms to steal her cello. She was compliant and waited, but after counting to 500 in her head, she realised the man was not coming back. Once the ordeal was over, the young woman called the police and courageously recounted the details of the attack. December 8th, 1974. It was reported the Cambridge rapist had struck again, this time on Owlstone Road. The 20-year-old woman was asleep. At approximately 2:30 a.m., she was jolted awake by the beam of a strong torch being pointed directly into her eyes. Instinctively, she went to click on the lamp that sat on her bedside table, but there was no power. The tension in the room was broken by the man who held the torch. The first thing he said was, "Don't scream, I've got a knife." He made her walk downstairs with the duvet from her bed wrapped around her shoulders. Her bedroom was on the top floor. A flatmate and her boyfriend heard the two sets of footsteps walk down the stairs and pass their room on the second floor. They heard a woman's voice say, "No, no, no." Unaware of the true nature of why the words were being uttered, the couple thought nothing more of it, deciding to stay in bed before falling back to sleep. The victim was taken into the garden. The intruder forced a pad that smelt strongly of chemicals over her mouth and nose along with a gag. But at one point during the attack, the man panicked, thinking he had lost his knife. The woman's gag slipped and she made a yelp. When no one responded, the rapist hurriedly grabbed a pair of tights that were hanging on a washing line and tied them over her mouth. He seemed to get a kick out of the woman's fear and distress. He told her, "I've got VD. I'm going to lock you in the shed and we'll come back and do you." He went on to say, "The police will never catch me. I have got a car and I'll be in London before they can do anything." The survivor would later tell investigators that the man had said to her if she reported him to the police, not only would he be coming back, but the police would examine her in unpleasant ways. She wasn't able to provide a description of her attacker. The latest rape was the fourth in 8 weeks, and the police felt it imperative they concentrate more of their resources into catching the man who was creating a wave of terror among the entire female population of Cambridge. The police continued to warn students to lock their doors and windows at night. December 15th on Victoria Road. A young woman was awoken by torchlight in the early hours of the morning. The light went off as quickly as it came on, when whoever was holding the torch realized her boyfriend was also in the bed. The intruder quickly ran out the door and the police were alerted. While authorities responded, they had a second call. The man had tried another house, but once again was disturbed and fled. At a third house, a 22-year-old American student telephonist was asleep in a property on Huntingdon Road. Her room was in the same building as the failed attack when the rapist had been kicked in the groin after he rang the doorbell semi-naked. Following a brutal attack, the victim's arms were covered in defensive wounds. She had been sliced with a knife while trying to protect herself. Detective Superintendent Bernard Hodson, who was in charge of the now 40-strong plainclothes team who were trying to capture the perpetrator, said, "The girl was raped in the flat where she lives alone, and her arms were cut by a knife in the struggle. She needed hospital care and 20 stitches in her right arm." Hodson warned the public that the rapist was extremely sick. "This man is a dangerous maniac who will strike again and again until we catch him. We are treating these attacks with all the seriousness of a murder inquiry."
The police have set up a special 24-hour phone line to enlist the public's help.
Hello, what are you being students room?
There were 1,000 calls in the first 2 days of the phone, but apart from the attacks themselves, the police don't have a single sighting they can be sure is genuine. Each one, though, crank or mistaken, has to be followed up, and 8 more detectives from the regional crime squad have now joined the team.
There was fear the brutal and violent rapist would move on to murder very soon if he were not caught. The revised loose description was given of the suspect. 5'5", between 25 and 30, slim build, with short dark hair. It was possible he may have had a beard and long hair during the time of the attacks. His clothing was dark. His jumper was green. The problem when trying to make an identification was the heavy disguises the attacker wore. He seldom carried out his crimes in daylight, and the survivors were deeply traumatized. A cohesive description could not be established. Some of the colleges in Cambridge began to screen male visitors, including boyfriends of the students, before they entered the grounds. The women-only colleges of Girton, Newhall and Newnham requested visitors show ID at the gates. A method of signing in and signing out was also employed to try and ensure the safety of the students as best the colleges could. Women started to carry rape alarms wherever they went. The devices let out a high-pitched wail when the button was pressed, hopefully drawing the attention of people nearby. Even though no attacks had been reported to police in a month, Detective Superintendent Bernard Hodson told the public to remain alert. "This man has already attacked a girl at a college in the city. Although he has not attacked anyone for a month, he could strike at any time, and we must not relax our vigilance."
Well, the trouble is that there have been no patterns emerging from these series of attacks. Therefore, he is quite unpredictable, and one never knows when he will strike again. Physically, we know that he is a small man. Mentally, we know that he appears to be an extremely sick man. At the present time, I have no evidence to suggest that we won't deal with it. The trouble is that it may be a long inquiry, and the public must face the fact.
Four months would pass since the last confirmed attack. Had the culprit left town, gone to prison, died? Or was he simply spooked by the press coverage and the students' awareness that a serial rapist was on the loose in Cambridge? Although there had not been an attack in several months, the rapist's presence was still felt. Graffiti began to pop up all around the city. Walls were spray-painted with the words, "Cambridge Rapist was here." Was this the rapist, or someone just tapping into the fear felt by the residents? What seemed more likely was the writing scrawled over an intended victim's window when the Cambridge rapist could not gain access to their property. In red letters written possibly in lipstick, it read, "Sleep tight." On Sunday, April 13th, 1975, the Cambridge rapist struck again, this time on Marshall Road. A 22-year-old secretary was awoken in the middle of the night by a man sitting on her bed. He was shining a torch into her eyes. She could not see his face. It was covered in a hooded mask with slits for eyes. The silver zip where his mouth should be was the same color as the blade being held to her throat. Light brown synthetic-looking hair came out of the bottom of the mask. In an attempt to make it appear as though he had a beard and shoulder-length hair, the attacker had carefully stitched a wig on the inside. He told his victim, "Do you know who I am? I am the Cambridge rapist." The woman calmly tried to talk to the intruder for half an hour in the hope that somehow he would be deterred. But the petrifying encounter ended the same way as many of the others. The woman was savagely raped. The survivor of the attack was left gagged, bound, and tucked into bed. For 5 hours, she tried to free herself before she was found and untied by a neighbor who heard the sounds of the woman trying desperately to get loose. More details of what the rapist wore were passed to the police. A black zip-up leather jacket, black trousers, and a hooded mask. Officers discovered a footprint in the bathroom, which tied to a nearby burglary. Speaking about the attack, Superintendent Hodson said, "This man has got to be a maniac. The girl was terrified out of her wits. We are pretty sure unless the rapist is a hermit, somebody in this university city knows of his bizarre disguise and his movements." It was believed he waited for an opportune time when the other residents of the flats were out, intently observing their comings and goings. Superintendent Hodson gave the students of Cambridge some advice. "Tell your boyfriends that the age of chivalry is not yet over. If a boyfriend decides to stay that night, that's up to him. It could well save a girl from a serious attack. I'm not saying they should sleep together. Perhaps the boy could find a spare bed or room, or perhaps he could play cards with friends for a few hours." One avenue of investigation which interested detectives was the possibility that the perpetrator could be a jockey. He appeared to be the right size. He was small and light, and Newmarket, which is famous for horse racing, was only 13 miles away from the centre of Cambridge. Jockeys were often seen in the city. In response to the attacks, some male students formed a telephone hotline which they encouraged female students to call if they were concerned for their safety.
"Pressure on the police is increased by the need to prevent another rape. Cambridge has a preponderance of young women, most of them in bedsitters, and in a few days an extra 2,000 girls will flood in for the university's May dances. The fears of Cambridge girls have now prompted men students at Caius College to set up a corps of bodyguards. Girls can phone the college each night between 9 and 10 and ask for their lodgings to be guarded. 2 student bodyguards are sent to each place. So far, only 15 to 20 girls a night have called for guards, and they were all too worried about being identified to appear before the camera. The scheme can only be a gallant help for a few girls, and clearly the city's nervousness can only be removed when the police have captured the rapist."
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
During the investigation, 8,000 men were questioned, and over 10,000 staff hours were logged on the job during the manhunt. Investigators still had very little to go on besides the perpetrator's blood group and a burgundy-coloured scarf which he had left at the scene when tying up one of the survivors. Detective Superintendent Bernard Hodson made a public appeal hoping to get to the rapist through a relative. A doting mother could be shielding this man. Any mother who is suspicious about her son's behaviour should contact us. This man is dangerous and will continue his attacks unless caught. Keeping the attacks in the press, during the first week of May, D.S. Hodson explained the urgency in catching the man responsible, who was also now known as the bedsit rapist. He is getting more dangerous and bolder with every attack. I fear that next time we could have a murder on our hands. That same day, another attack was reported. Unfortunately, Bernard Hodson was right. The rapist did get bolder with his next crime. In broad daylight, a 21-year-old secretary walked home during the afternoon to her small bedsit in a terraced house on Pye Terrace. She expected to go back to an empty room, but the rapist was waiting for her in his usual disguise. Hair poked out from the masked hood at the front as well as the sides. This time the word rapist was painted across the forehead of the mask. Even more terrifying than what he was wearing was the large knife he was holding. He used the weapon to stab the petrified, screaming woman in the stomach as he attacked her. He knew her name and her boyfriend's name. He hoped by using them she would be too frightened to report the crime. Terrified he might return. After yet another callous attack, he bound his victim who was bleeding heavily. The rapist fled and disappeared, blending in with a slew of people that had left a local factory to go on their lunch break. He vanished, appearing as just another random face in the crowd. Half an hour passed, and amazingly, the woman escaped her ties and managed to get to a local telephone box to call herself an ambulance. She needed emergency surgery. The man that the police were desperately looking for had returned to where he had left his boat. He came back unnoticed before anyone knew he was gone. He even spoke with people at the dock, watching the ambulances rush to the scene of his latest unimaginable crime. With the news of yet another rape, the investigating team jumped into action. Roadblocks were set up, and every male spotted that matched the attacker's height and description was questioned. Though the investigating team were no closer to finding an answer, they had had a pool of suspects which included the rapist. He was seen at Bonham's boatyard during lunchtime when the daylight attack occurred. Frustratingly at the time, the police were looking for a man they thought was in his 20s, though the rapist was in fact twice that age. When asked among the other suspects to bring his ID to the police station back in December, he complied, saying, "I wondered how long it would be before you came to see me. I'm the right build, but I'm 47. For some of the crimes, he provided alibis, and his acquaintances confirmed what he said, but did so in good faith. He had snuck out to commit the crimes and came back before anyone knew any different. Though his disguises may not have been convincing, they were distracting and scary enough to frighten witnesses into wanting to forget any and all aspects of the attacker's description.
Superintendent Bernard Hodson works 16 hours a day and has done 7 days a week for the last 8 months as head of the rape inquiry. During that time, his team of 60 have come up with almost no clues. That's brought criticism and has increased pressures on the police. An identikit picture of the rapist is almost all they've got to go on.
The rapist needed to be caught fast, and the police knew it. They kept watch, surveilling some of the suspects. Officers were doing overnight shifts, waiting in the streets for any man that might seem suspicious. An entire month passed, and nothing was reported. The women of Cambridge remained on high alert. The news of the menace could have passed by the next intended victim. She had been in the country only 2 weeks, coming from Canada as a medical student. Jane Sproul was staying in accommodation linked to her university on Owlstone Croft. 19 students had rooms in the complex, and Jane lived on the ground floor. During the early hours of June 8th, she heard a noise, sounding like someone in the room next door. Then a minute later, a knock at the door. Opening it only slightly, she saw a man in a leather mask standing outside armed with a knife. He managed to lunge and slash at her hands when she tried to slam the door shut. A tendon on her wrist was severed. But luckily, there had been a chain lock preventing the door from being fully opened. Jane let out a scream loud enough to wake the dead, alerting her neighbours or distracting them from their televisions if they were still up. Several people reach for their telephones to notify the police. Two fishermen, Harry Jeffries and Ray Holland, trying to catch eels on the River Cam 200 yards from Jane's accommodation, rush to the scene. Harry, who later spoke about the incident, said, "All of a sudden, there was this blood-curdling cry. Ray grabbed a fishing knife and I grabbed a great hunk of iron. We sprinted back to the hostel and searched the grounds. All the lights were on inside the hostel. We looked through the windows and saw no one about." As Ray Holland went to find a phone box to call the police, Harry Jeffries was left standing in the dark looking through the window. He would later say, "While Ray was away, I noticed a man dash like the clappers in the hostel corridor." The rapist had fled the scene. He must have had a copy of the key which opened the main door, or maybe it was a skeleton key. When Harry Jeffries finally managed to get into the building after a caretaker opened the back door, he ran down the corridor and then saw Jane. It was clear she was severely injured. Harry told the reporter, "There was blood on the floor, walls and ceiling after she tried to fight off her attacker." It was revealed days later that Jane Sproul was aware that there was a rapist menacing thousands of female students in Cambridge. Her father had been on a trip to Vancouver and came across a small article about the man's crimes. Knowing that Jane was going to Cambridge to study for 10 weeks, he told her to be cautious, lock her doors and windows, and not to walk alone. She called her father a few days later to update him on her injuries. Jane told him, "There's nothing to worry about. My wrist will have to stay in a cast, which means no more sports like scuba diving for a while." Officers waiting in back alleys and patrolling the streets got the signal they had been waiting for: to stop anything that moved. Detective Constable Terry Edwards heard the news of the attack and was on high alert, monitoring Selwyn Road less than half a mile west. In a city full of cyclists, one was pedalling in his direction, on an old blue and cream-coloured bike. A basket and plastic bags were on top of the handlebars, but it had no lights. Riding at a leisurely pace, a woman with long fair hair wearing a moleskin coat came closer. As she approached, almost brushing past Edwards, something didn't seem right, and he shouted for her to stop. Upon hearing the words, the cyclist began to pedal faster, trying to increase their pace with DC Edwards in hot pursuit. The officer reached out and grabbed the woman's hair, but a wig came off in his hands. Luckily, this had unbalanced the cyclist, who came crashing to the ground. Determined, he jumped on the suspect before they could escape. However, in spite of doing his best to detain them, DC Edwards' handheld police radio picked the worst time to stop working. Edwards could not call for backup. Fortunately, the commotion had roused some residents in homes nearby who were watching the dramatic scene from their windows. Edward shouted, "Call the police." Sharon Pearl, observing the scene from her bedroom after hearing the crash of the bike, did just that, and backup was on its way. When the suspect was finally apprehended, It was discovered the bicycle basket and plastic bags contained some clothes and a disguise, which included a handmade black hooded mask that had been fashioned from a leather handbag. The suspect just so happened to be carrying their passport and £150 in Spanish currency. They had been prepared to leave England at the slightest sign of detection. However, the only place they would be travelling was to a prison cell. Peter Samuel Cook had a checkered past. It started with court appearances from the tender age of 9, at which time he was sentenced to 3 years in a borstal for 8 charges, including theft. At least 3 more appearances in juvenile court followed throughout his teens. He was again arrested for robbing a woman's clothing shop when he was due to be transported to Dartmoor from a court in Cambridge. He escaped his 5-year prison sentence by climbing through a trapdoor in the ceiling with 2 other prisoners. It was reported the trio got through 3 locked doors before they found freedom. Later that evening, police were called when 2 houses were broken into in that area. Cook, 23 at the time and registered on his court papers as a bricklayer, was thought to be responsible along with his accomplices. The police missed them this time, but would catch up with Cook a few months later in Glasgow. He was then sent back to Cambridge and sentenced to 7 years in prison. But he was again transferred, this time to Springfield Hospital in London, when his mental health became a concern for doctors. Cook now had another opportunity to flee and made it as far as Austria, before he was captured there a few years later. Even though he had managed to get far away from his prison sentence in England, he wound up in an Austrian prison, which is how he was discovered. Cook was given 10 months rigorous imprisonment there and was then deported back to the UK. After he was released, he kept his head down with sporadic employment on building sites, earning the nickname The Fly because of his remarkable agility. However, Cook never left his life of crime behind, continuing to steal and commit a string of petty thefts. After more court appearances, he found himself sentenced to 18 months in Broadmoor Hospital. He was released around 8 years before the Cambridge rapes began, when psychiatrists believed there was nothing mentally wrong with him. Therefore, there was no need to keep him in a psychiatric hospital. Over the years, Cook's father, hoping to keep his son on the straight and narrow, gave Cook a considerable amount of money after the sale of some land. Cook received a cheque for £12,000, but it made no difference. He always went back to committing theft and burglary, not to survive financially, but under motivations only he knew. In what could have been a sign of things to come, Cook often left a calling card at the home of his victims, and after committing burglary, he would write his initials on mirrors in the property. At the time of the rapes, Cook was a driver for the Dollamore Wine Company. He lived in a luxury caravan with his wife Margaret on Limes Road in Hardwick, 5 miles west of the centre of Cambridge. The caravan was on the land of Cook's elderly parents Sam and Dora, who allowed their son and daughter-in-law to stay next to the small bungalow where they lived. Margaret was 14 years Cook's junior, and by 1974 they had been married for 6 years. Margaret worked as a bookbinder for a publishing house, and Peter Cook also had a job on the side towing boats. They both earned a decent wage, and their outgoings for their home were minimal. They shared the property with their 3 pet cats, which, according to Margaret, her husband Peter adored. Cook also loved spending time on his small boat, which he christened Margaret after his wife. Nothing in his past seemed to indicate a violent nature or alert authorities to believe he was a sexual predator. An accomplished house burglar, he was tending to favour the more affluent homes in Cambridge. A friend of Peter Samuel Cook's described the man he had known for 7 years. Quote, "He was very shy with people he didn't know, but if you knew him, you couldn't stop him talking. He loved boats and was skillful. He also loved animals." When Cook's caravan and workshop were searched, it was a treasure trove of evidence. He had hundreds of pieces of women's underwear along with clothing and 13 wigs. The items in the workshop were stashed away in a hidden compartment, as it was also a space used by his father. The disturbing list of items was long. It included a bottle of ether, approximately 100 house keys, some skeleton keys all neatly labelled, which enabled him to sneak around homes undetected, 2 books crammed full with names and addresses, and details of 180 women living in central Cambridge. It appeared as though when Cook had covertly visited some of the women's homes, he rifled through their belongings and gleaned an insight into their lives, getting their names and sometimes that of their boyfriends through the written correspondence or post left around the victim's property. Cook's size, agility, and previous criminal experience made getting into the bedsits almost routine. Amongst his things were an extensive collection of pornographic films, books, and magazines, the viewing of which he would later blame for the spree of violent, horrific sex crimes. Cook had also meticulously cut out and neatly stored paper cuttings reporting the rapes he had committed. At the first remand hearing of Peter Samuel Cook, the women of Cambridge came to the court in droves, angry at the man who had terrorised them and their city for 8 long months. 300 women surrounded the court. Fearing a full-on riot, a decoy was used on the way into the Guildhall Court with success, but on the way out the crowd had realised they were duped. Eventually, Cook had to be transported out through a back entrance shrouded in a blanket, with the police car having to be backed right up to the door. Before the hearing, in the courtroom, DS Bernard Hodson appealed to the press not to divulge the names of the survivors except Jane Sproul. He said, "I would ask you not to release any of the names of the victims with the exception of number 9. The name of that girl was released on humanitarian grounds yesterday in order to save anxiety for parents of hundreds of girls living in the city." Hodson was backed up by Chairman of the Magistrates Vivian Ramsbottom, who added, "We have no authority to ask you not to release the names, but I'm sure you will understand it would be in the interest of the girls and appreciated by the court if you did not reveal the names." It is unknown if the psychological cruelty as well as the trauma of a physical assault deterred additional survivors from coming forward, but Peter Samuel Cook pleaded guilty to 6 counts of rape, 1 count of buggery, and 2 charges of unlawful wounding at Norwich Crown Court during early October 1975. Other charges which he denied included 1 count of attempted rape and 2 of wounding with intent. Cook's pleas of not guilty for the remaining three charges were accepted. One of the survivors of his attacks bravely watched from the public gallery. As Cook admitted guilt to most of the charges, the survivors of the crimes avoided having to give evidence at a lengthy trial in court. During mitigation, counsel for the defense told the court that a psychiatrist had appealed to the rapist while he was still at large. Cook claimed to have made contact with the doctor via telephone, expressing dual feelings about the rapes. Half of him felt compelled to do it, and the other half felt regret. When a meeting was planned, Cook didn't attend, and contact stopped there. Brian Hicks QC told the court his client first purchased a pornographic book in 1972. From there, Cook progressed to watching films. Cook claimed that after 6 months of obsessively watching these films, he was, quote, driven to rape. Hicks then tried to share responsibility for Cook's crimes with pornographers, telling the court, "You may think the purveyors of these films must bear some responsibility for these offences." Cook had purchased an at-home projector, spending most of a month's wages on it. He would invite friends round to watch the films which he bought from a sex shop in Cambridge. The owner of the shop relayed in court that Cook was persistent with his requests for new movies. Brian Hicks QC mentioned Margaret, Peter Cook's wife, who attended court every day of the proceedings. He said, "She has remained loyal to her husband and is prepared to wait for his eventual release from prison." The judge, Mr. Justice Melford Stevenson, told Peter Cook, "One thing emerges very clearly from your record, and that is that you have acquired some skill in talking to psychiatrists. But the fact which stands out is that you showed no compassion to your victims. You used them to gratify your lust, and you terrorized a very considerable community." Passing sentence, the judge concluded, "I express the opinion that in the context of this case, life ought to mean life. I well realise this opinion will horrify large numbers of well-meaning people, but I am satisfied it is right. Put him away." Peter Samuel Cook received 2 life sentences. In 1978, there was a great deal of speculation in the press when Cook applied for gender reassignment surgery. The tabloids expressed concern that if Cook's surgery were approved, he would be moved to a female prison, and in an act of sympathy, the parole board might potentially let him out early on license. He had previously asked prison authorities if he could wear women's clothing. Coincidentally, it was reported that Cook had Klinefelter syndrome, where males are born with an extra female chromosome. Although not officially confirmed, it was deemed probable, as before Cook was captured, a forensic sample from one of the crime scenes identified that the culprit was infertile, a symptom of the condition. It was also said Cook had to undergo surgery in his 20s to remove excess breast tissue. Peter Cook's request for reassignment surgery was ultimately declined. So where are we now? The Cambridge rapist made an impression on designers Vivienne Westwood and Malcolm McLaren. They created a t-shirt on which was printed a similar mask to the one that Peter Cook wore during his crime spree, along with the words Cambridge rapist. The t-shirt made its way into pop culture and is now a collector's item, shown at both the Victoria and Albert Museum in London and the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. After the trial, Margaret, Peter Cook's wife, became the focal point when the Cambridge rapist was mentioned. She feared eviction from the caravan she had shared with Cook, as his parents were disgusted with it being on their land. They wanted to burn it down. Peter Cook's father, Sam, who was then in his 70s, said, "Every time we look out of our kitchen window, the sight of the caravan brings back memories, and that's not good for either of us." His wife Dora denied being forceful when asking Margaret to leave, but felt that she could not have her stay there. She said, "I'm broken-hearted, terribly broken-hearted." Sadly, Margaret laid the blame for the attacks at her own door, not her husband's, believing if she had sex with him upon every request, which was a few times a day, he would not have become the Cambridge rapist. She reportedly said, "I think if I had given in every time he wanted me, he wouldn't have done those horrible things." On January 9, 2004, a Home Office spokesman provided a statement about the man dubbed the Cambridge rapist. She said, "A prisoner died at HMP Winchester. Peter Samuel Cook was pronounced dead at 8:50 p.m. on Wednesday. He died of natural causes. Peter Cook was 75 years old." Thank you for listening. A special thanks goes out to longtime listener and Patreon producer Joe Tompkins and everyone who supports us on Patreon. For more information on this episode, please see the show notes or visit our website, theywalkamonguspodcast.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.